reducing clauses go. This Court has dealt with reducing clauses in general terms in the Dauhauer case and found such clauses to be unambiguous and not contrary to public policy. The place that we start in looking at the reducing clause here is the statute itself. Subsection 5(i)(2) states that reductions are allowed for amounts payable under any workers' compensation law. The word any is one that is a broad and expansive term, and it implies that just what it says.
Can I interrupt you for a minute? Do you think that the legislature ever really considered this type of situation when they adopted 632.32? In other words, you can make a strong argument that they use the term any, as you just did. But do you think that they ever envisioned that those payments would go to the state treasury rather than to an insured or to an insured's estate?
Two comments in response. I don't know, frankly, whether they considered that specifically or not. And that's one of the problems with doing some of the things that the shearers have done in this case. And if they've looked at public policy considerations and historical considerations, and one of the problems with doing that is it's hard to figure out what the legislature really intended because you've got a bunch of legislators all having different intentions and goals. So it's hard to figure out exactly what they wanted to do. So I don't know that we can say that that's something that was completely considered.
Let's say for a minute that we think that this statute is not unambiguous but ambiguous, and we decide to look at legislative history. Is there anything that you're aware of in the legislative history that would be helpful to us?
I am not aware of anything that would be helpful. There are a number of statements, things that were not included in the briefing that reflect amendments that were proposed, modifications to the end of subsection I that were not adopted. And again, we're dealing then with what does that mean? Is there some significance to that or not? And I don't know that we really can come up with a legislative intent. And that's why I think that we need to look at things that are reliable.
So you're asking us basically to look at the plain meaning of the statute as set forth in the statute itself.
Exactly. And just to follow up, I was going to make two points in response to your first inquiry. The second point is that as far as what this Court should do in interpreting what the legislative intent was with regard to this particular enactment, the courts have said that the legislature is presumed to enact laws and statutes knowing what the other statutes are, knowing what the law is. In this particular case, the legislature then is presumed to know how the workers' compensation statutes operate, that there are some payments that do go to the state fund, and under what circumstances those payments go to the state fund. And we discussed in our brief the fact that the legislative plan that is embodied in the workers' compensation statute is kind of an all-encompassing plan, and it evidences a public policy that I think is one that's very, very reliable for this Court to deal with, and that is that there is a public policy expressed in that comprehensive plan that the further you get away in relationship to somebody who is injured, the less that person has a right to recover as a result of that injury. And that's evidenced in this case. The comp statutes make the determination that spouses and children are dependents that are entitled to a death benefit. But when you get to the parent level of an adult child, that's getting to be far enough removed that the monies, instead of going to the parents, should go to the state fund. That reflects a policy that once you get so far removed, there really isn't a right or an equity or a public policy to get that money to that particular person. And so knowing that overall public policy scheme of the workers' compensation statutes, I think it can be said that by referring to payments made under any workers' compensation statute in subsection I-2, the legislature was taking that public policy into account and did understand, arguably, that there were going to be cases just like this one where there were not going to be payments made to the parents, and then there was going to be a reduction in the uninsured motorist coverage as a result of that. So, bottom line, I think that a good argument can be made that public policy, that is the legislative intent, that what happened here is exactly what the legislature intended to happen here.
Counselor, to me it seems like there are really two questions. One question is whether American Family could write a policy that would permit a reduction under this fact scenario, and you refer us to the statute for that. Now, say I buy that argument that, yeah, the statute permits a reduction when a person dies and they leave no dependents and the payment is made into the state. It permits an insurance company to make such a reduction. Does it really necessarily follow that because the statute permits it, a reasonable insured who reads this policy would understand that under these facts a reduction would occur? To me, it's a very different question.
Yes, and I think I've got two answers.
Okay. I'm most concerned about the contract issue, frankly. So.
Okay. This is why I emphasized at the outset that we're dealing with not Scott Shearer, who purchased the policy, but his parents. We have a situation where Scott Shearer could have purchased insurance, maybe didn't purchase insurance. Nobody has to have liability insurance in Wisconsin. So as far as expectations of the parents of an adult child with regard to recovery, I don't think that can be said that they really had an expectation.
Yeah, aren't they suing on behalf of his estate?
Pardon?
Aren't they suing on behalf of his estate under the wrongful death statute? Isn't that what they're suing?
They are pursuing a wrongful death action, which, as I understand it, is when somebody dies, they have survivors have a cause of action for their loss of society and companionship and any pecuniary losses that were sustained.
Yeah, but I'm not looking at what their expectation was. I'm looking at what his expectation was, because to me that's what's important. What did he think? He was the policy purchaser. They were not. And if he would read this policy, and you have to make him a reasonable insured because it's not specific to who purchased the policy. But if a reasonable insured read this policy, the purchaser, the insured, would they believe that under this fact set, where money is not paid into his estate but paid to the state, that there would be a reduction?
I think that he would.
Why is that?
The scenario that you posed there is because the language is clear. It says that there's going to be a reduction for any comp payments made. Any comp payments made. It's very clear on the plain language what is going to happen. So if he read that language, I think it's very clear.
But if you read the overall provisions of the uninsured motorist section of the policy, all of the payments that are talked about there, or the amount that you can get in insurance, refers to a payment to the insured. It doesn't refer to a payment to anybody else. I mean, the whole purpose of that section is if the guy who's liable doesn't have insurance and can't pay you, your own insurance company, as a first-party claim, will pay you. Do you see what I'm saying? I'm looking at it in the whole context of this provision of the policy, and I agree with you that if I track it according to the statute, that's not a tough analysis to come up with your answer. But when I read the policy, I don't anticipate that the reasonable policyholder is going to run get the statute and see does it track the statute and then try to figure out, well, what did the statute or the legislature envision? That person's going to read the policy and say, oh, well, you know, yeah, it's a reduction if I get paid for workers' comp. I mean, that's a reasonable interpretation, isn't it, of the statute, since that provision talks about payments that aren't forthcoming to the insured? Why isn't that also a reference to payments to the insured? Now, am I making my point at all clear? I'm not doing a great job, I know, of asking the question.
Let me see if I can maybe answer what I think you're asking.
Okay, what's bugging me there, in there?
I think that as I understand it, there's the suggestion by the Shearers and by the amicus brief that there's a policy or that there's a characterization of uninsured motorist coverage that somebody expects a certain level of payment given a loss. And that is a statement of policy that was effectively generated in order to deal with and answer earlier questions about what the nature of uninsured motorist coverage is.
No, I'm not worried about that. I am worried about reading the writings that's in the insurance policy, not a policy with the small p, but American Family Policy with a capital P. And what I'm worried about is section number 3, which talks about uninsured motorist coverage, which is where this reducing clause occurs, correct?
Yes.
All right. I am worried about that section because what it talks about, as I read it generally, is you get paid if somebody else doesn't pay you, right? Isn't that what that section's all about? If the guy that's at fault doesn't pay you for the accident, your own policy will pay you up to a certain amount.
Subject to any reduction.
Okay, right. Okay, so it will pay you up to a certain amount. Then as you read through it, it says, well, yeah, we're going to pay you, but we're going to pay you reduced by these other payments. And I guess my concern is, why isn't it a reasonable interpretation of that section that because what they're talking about is American Family paying Scott, that the reduction should be also by a payment to Scott? And I'm just looking at policy language. I'm not talking about policy as a generic term. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so.
Okay.
And the reason, Your Honor, is that there isn't that kind of a limitation in the wording of the policy language.
If you read the little snippet you're reading, I agree with you. But you don't read a policy snippet by snippet. We're reading a whole section here on, at least I am, on uninsured motorists. And as it fits within the context of that part of the statute, why isn't it reasonable for Scott to have assumed that the payment reduction they're talking about is because he got paid?
And as I understand that, right, you want to focus on subsection 3.
Why take it as a whole, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but so all right. The insuring clause describes what will be paid,
right,
and when it will be paid,
right,
subject to,
right,
the various reductions,
right,
one of which is the limits of liability of this coverage will be reduced by,
right,
a payment made or amount payable because of bodily injury under any workers' compensation or disability benefits law or any similar law. And that is a broad statement. I think this is where we get to the analogy with the Sider versus O'Connell case. That case, I think, is a case that is pretty much dispositive of this issue. The suggestion has been by the Shearers that the ambiguity in the policy language and in the statute is because there's a breadth of the reducing clause that doesn't make sense and it should be less than what it is on its face. That was the issue in the Sider case. In that case, the Court was dealing with the valued policy law, and the question was, what is the meaning of the word dwelling? And the statute used the word dwelling. The Commissioner of Insurance said, well, that's too broad, and so the Commissioner of Insurance effectively interpreted that, promulgated a rule, and said that what dwelling really means is a dwelling that is not also used for commercial purpose. So it's analogous to what's being done here, that there's a breadth to this statute that says any workers' compensation law. And what the Shearers want to do is they want to tack on the language payments to the insured. So it's analogous to what the Commissioner of Insurance did in the Sider case. And what the Court said in that case is that just because a statute is broad doesn't make it ambiguous.
Counsel,
bodily injury mean the same in the workers' compensation as it does in the policy? In other words, are we talking about the same thing? In the policy, it talks about bodily injury. In the statute, I would agree with you that the statute says that amounts paid or payable under any workers' compensation law. What does the workers' compensation law say about bodily injury? Is bodily injury and death the same thing? Are they? Excuse me.
I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, would that make a difference?
I don't think that it would.
Well, and why not? We're talking about under 632.32, it says for uninsured motorist coverage for bodily injury or death resulting from one accident. Do you think they're synonymous terms? They're the same?
I'm sorry.
You think that they're the same, bodily injury and death? Here or death? If there had been bodily injury, obviously he were still living, then there would have been payment. And whatever that payment was would have been reduced. That we agree on.
Yes.
But because he passed away, is that the same? The policy says payable because of bodily injury under any workman's compensation.
And bodily injury includes death according to the policy.
According to the policy, okay.
Yes.
Pardon? According to the policy, and you're equating that with 632.32, that it means the same thing?
No, I'm not saying that it goes backwards. I'm just saying that according to the terms of the policy, it includes death. In that regard, I think the language of the policy is a little bit less expansive and less inclusive than what the statute allows in subsection 5I2. I'd also on that point note that subsection 5E of the statute allows for reductions and reducing clauses and other exclusions that are not prohibited by the statutes or other laws. So there can be variation, there can be different terms to a policy, and those terms can still be appropriate under that catch-all phrase of the statute.
There's something that seems patently unfair about this, in other words, because there wasn't any money paid. But your argument is that, well, the statute allows it, and the policy follows the statute. In other words, there's no ambiguity, and it's a plain reading. So that...
Yes, but it goes beyond that, Your Honor. I don't stop at the point of saying that that because this is ambiguous, this is what we have to do. There's a second part to the argument, and this is something that was done in the CIDR case, and it's allowed. You can look at policy. You can look at extrinsic matters to confirm that an interpretation of an unambiguous statute is appropriate. And that is what we have here. We have bodies of law that demonstrate that the result in this case, the fact that the that there was a reduction in the uninsured motorist payments and that the parents of an adult who is injured do not get paid, is in conformance with bodies of law, one being the workers' compensation law. We know that that happens because we have the parents not getting paid by the comp law and it's the money going into the state. This Court, in the Wells case, dealt with public policy, the public policy of the state of Wisconsin with regard to what can parents recover in the way of damages when their adult children are injured.
That was Wells versus Bowen Lumberman case, right?
It's the state of Wells.
I think it was. I just...
Counsel, if I may, I'd like to return to your plain language 632.32. I remember when I first got in this Court, I wrote a case that said the statute was clear, and it was clear, and it was obviously clear. But then a couple years later, we had a different fact situation that involved the Internet. And boy, that statute sure got ambiguous quickly in that context because it didn't appear as though it made any sense. And I look at your definition argument in 632.32(1), or rather I-2, and you say amounts paid or payable under any workers' compensation law. Now, there's a lot of workers' compensation law, and some of the workers' compensation law deals with penalties against the employer. 102.35 is in Chapter 102, workers' compensation law, and that requires an employer under the workers' compensation law to pay a penalty for unreasonable refusal to rehire. There's a provision of the workers' compensation law that requires the employer under the workers' compensation law to pay a 10% penalty. There's a provision of the workers' compensation law that requires employers to pay fines of up to thousands of dollars for lying to their employees about coverage. There are provisions under the workers' compensation law that require employers to pay surcharges as repeat offenders when they are uninsured and they're supposed to have insurance. Those are all payments made under the workers' compensation law. Under your plain meaning argument, is that to be an offset under uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage?
You may answer the question, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That wasn't what he wanted to hear.
In fact, I welcome the question. I'm sorry. I welcome the question because there is an answer to it. And this was suggested in the briefing. When you look at the policy in this case.
I want to stay with the plain meaning of the language.
Pardon?
I want to stay with the plain meaning of the statute. That's where I am. I want to know, you're saying it's clear and unambiguous. I've given you fact situations where I think your interpretation makes causes some concern.
I have several levels of response. First of all, those are hypothetical situations that we don't have here. Smith versus Atlantic Mutual, a case decided by this Court a number of years ago, said we don't decide cases on hypothetical situations because it's important to consider the particular facts and figure out how they fit in or don't fit in. To do things on hypothetical bases causes problems. As you mentioned, when you have a different factual situation, you can have a different result that may not fit.
Different explanation.
Pardon?
Try your second explanation.
Okay. The second is one that relates to the actual policy language that is being used in this case. The statute, as I said earlier, I think is probably a little bit broader than the policy language. When you look at the statute, or excuse me, look at the policy here, we're looking at really two parts to it to answer the Court's question, and that is, what is the payment because of, and who is the payment to? Now, the situations that you posed are the because of part. What is the statute because, or what is the payment because of? And there are a number of different things that it could be because of. The policy language deals with that. When you look at the reducing clause, well, first of all, the two-part is the same as the statute. The payment to is, it is unrestricted. It could be to anyone, as we have argued. But the because of part is restricted. The policy talks about a payment made or amount payable because of bodily injury under any workers' compensation and so forth. Then when you work back to the insuring clause, we have payments being made because of bodily injury to a person, always using the singular term in describing what their the payments are because of. So we see that the policy is tying the because of part to a particular injury to a particular person. So all of the statutes that relate to a penalty for a general activity or a payment for another person who is injured, those things are all things that are not included within the scope of the language of the policy. So the policy is clearly within within reason, and it makes sense, and it's clear on its face that the because of part is being tied to the bodily injury of this particular person, not of any number of other because of possibilities.
Thank you. Justice Prosser.
I'm sorry I was a little late, and you may have spoken to this, but why was it that Mr. Shiro was qualified for workers' comp? Why did he qualify for workers' comp coverage?
Well, he was at the time he was on a business trip. He was he had his own personal vehicle. He was going to Minnesota. It broke down on the way. He rented another vehicle, and they got to Minnesota, and then they were involved in the accident. So he was injured while on the job.
Suppose he had been in Minnesota on a vacation. What would be the result then? Wouldn't the result have been that he wouldn't have had any workers' comp coverage?
Right.
Correct.
And under those circumstances, wouldn't the insurance company have had to pay?
To the extent that Minnesota law would allow it, yes.
And the beneficiaries could have been his parents?
Could have been.
Isn't it kind of illusory for someone who buys an insurance policy to pay for uninsured and underinsured coverage, maybe a great deal if they're smart, and then get not a penny out of it when there's a death?
No, that's not the case. I had a good answer, but I lost my train of thought.
Well, we've upheld reducing clauses.
Pardon?
We have upheld the statute, haven't we?
Yes.
And reducing clauses that match the statute.
Yes.
Upheld.
Yes.
You couldn't have a reducing statute that was broader. I'm sorry, a reducing policy that was broader than the statute, reduced more. Maybe you couldn't.
Well, I think arguably you could, Your Honor, under subsection 5 that allows for reductions that are not necessarily specified in the statute, so long as they are not contrary to law. So I think arguably you could, that there are certain subsections of the statute that by their terms are so specific that you have to be within those terms.
When I read your policy, I saw nothing that defined insured as the estate. In fact, there's a definition that says insured as you, and you is defined as the insured. So when you sit down, see if there's anything in this policy that allows payment to an estate.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Please. Okay. Thank you. Eric S. Darling, representing the Shearers.
May it please the Court, Counsel, thank you for the opportunity to address you this afternoon. My name is Eric Darling, and I represent the original plaintiffs, Bernard and Maria Shearer, who are seated to my left. At least before I got involved in this case, I would have said, and I would guess that most lawyers who practice in this area would have said, and I would guess that most judges who hear cases such as these would have said, that the fundamental purpose of reducing clauses, which are obviously the subject of many decisions in the recent past, that the fundamental purpose of these clauses is to allow the insurer to reduce its policy limit by amounts the insured claimant has already received from other sources. Every case that we've had an opportunity to review in preparation for today that otherwise deals with the interpretation or enforcement of a reducing clause does so in a situation where the payments in question have been received by the claimant, or perhaps in the case of a death, have been received by his or her survivors. So simply put, it is unprecedented for an insurance company to seek a reduction in its own obligation to its own insured in a situation where the payments that they're seeking the reduction for were neither made by the insurer in question nor received by or on behalf of the insured in question.
Well, there was some legislative history here about making whole. Familiar with that?
The legislative history that I assume you're referring to deals with the question of the purpose of mandatory uninsured motorist coverage. It's an attempt, as close as is reasonably possible, to put the insured in the same position they would have been in had the tortfeasor in question had insurance, or at least had insurance in an amount equal to the amount of uninsured motorist coverage in question. In this particular case, Scott Shearer carried $150,000 worth of uninsured motorist coverage. And I think this might be a good point to address the question that you posed to counsel before he sat down, and that is that the American Family policy in question clearly does cover a situation such as this. If you look in the section of the policy we were looking at a little while ago, insured, well, first of all, the grant of coverage says that the American Family is to pay damages for bodily injury which an insured person is legally entitled to recover from the owner or operator of an uninsured motor vehicle. Insured person, in turn, means anyone entitled to recover damages due to bodily injury to you, you in this case being Scott Shearer, and bodily injury in the policy is defined to include death. So what the grant of coverage indicates in the uninsured motorist coverage is that anyone who's otherwise entitled to recover damages due to a death sustained by Scott Shearer is an insured person under the uninsured motorist coverage.
Well, but this is a wrongful death, and the insured person is not entitled to anything.
The insured person is the one who was killed.
That's right.
And
under the statute, the insured person doesn't collect. It's either an identified relative.
Right? Under the wrongful death laws of both Wisconsin and Minnesota, as I understand Minnesota law, the relatives are the owners of the cause of action.
Right, not the insured, not the decedent.
Right, but the named insured and the insured, for purposes of interpreting the uninsured motorist coverage, are two different concepts.
Right.
Scott Shearer's parents are insured persons under the uninsured motorist coverage because they are people entitled to bring a claim as a result of his death, to recover damages as a result of his death.
I don't want to get into Minnesota and Wisconsin law, but that's not been briefed as to which law applies. Is that right?
It's not been extensively briefed. It was argued at the trial level that this would be Minnesota law applicable, and it was ruled at the trial level that Minnesota law would recognize a recovery against this particular tortfeasor in favor of this set of plaintiffs. That is not a subject of this appeal.
Okay. Nor is the Workers' Comp Act of Wisconsin applicable, not Minnesota?
Apparently so, and I say that simply because it was under Wisconsin workers' compensation law that these payments to the state fund were made. Now, I'm no workers' compensation expert, but I'm assuming that's because that this was a Wisconsin resident employed by a Wisconsin employer who happened to be in Minnesota on out-of-town business at the time of the accident, but he's still subject to Wisconsin workers' compensation law. That is what kicked in these payments to the state fund in the first place.
Well, how do we get to the results you want? It says, in effect, any workers' comp payments shall be reduced, shall reduce recovery. It doesn't say to whom, right? It could say, so in that sense, we don't know. It could mean any workers' comp payments made to anyone, including the state, right? Or it could say any workers' comp payments made to the claimant under this policy, right?
Right.
So is that why it's ambiguous?
I believe that that's why it's ambiguous in this context. Now, in American Families Brief, much has been made of the fact that the statute in question has been found to be unambiguous in a number of other contexts, the sort of context that we're normally dealing with when we're dealing with reducing clauses, namely cases in which the third-party payments in question have actually been paid to or on behalf of the insured person. In this particular case, if we just focus on the language of the statute, the point you make is correct. We can do this linguistic dance and say it does not say to whom, so doesn't that raise a question of whether it meant to the insured or to anyone? Implicit in American Families' position is that it necessarily has to mean to anyone. That because there is not a limiting qualifier, it necessarily has to mean to anyone. But just looking at it linguistically, I think you can just as credibly say that because there is no expansive qualifier, that it can't mean, that it has to mean to anyone. And that's the ambiguity, and that's what allows us to look to the legislative history.
But your workman's comp would only be paid to certain, and that's where you get paid into the fund. So if you read, as you're calling our attention, to 632.32.5.1, it says that a policy may provide that the limits under the policy for uninsured, I'm going to skip, motorist coverage for bodily injury or death resulting from one accident may be reduced by amounts paid under the workman's comp law. That's what happened here. It was paid.
An amount was paid?
Yes. Now,
state.
Okay. So then the policy itself says a payment made or payable, and it follows the language because of bodily injury. I asked about death, but under any workers' compensation or disability benefits law, so that's what happened. That's what was done. What you're saying, and you may be correct, is that you read that, or you read in, as the Court of Appeals did, the word insured. There has to be a benefit. Someone has to get that through the insured.
And conversely, American Family and the trial judge and the dissenting judge at the Court of Appeals reads in to anyone, both at the statutory level and at the insurance policy.
No, I don't think they have to read anything in, because I'm not going to debate that, but it seems amounts paid under any workers' compensation law, you're reading in to anyone. It's just amounts paid.
Right. It says amounts paid. the focus of one of American Families' points today is that it's under any workers' compensation law, whether it's a payment under the Wisconsin workers' compensation law or Minnesota is not the issue here. This is clearly a payment under a work comp law.
Right. In the payment.
But the ambiguity that does exist, I believe, in the context of this case is a few words before where it says amounts paid. It doesn't say to anyone, nor does it say to the insured. That's where the ambiguity exists. And the fact that this statute has been found to otherwise be unambiguous in other contexts where the question of whether it means to anyone versus to the insured is not really material does not mean that it's not ambiguous in this context where it is the key issue in the case. American Family's argument necessarily infers the words to anyone. I will admit that my argument necessarily infers the words to the insured, or at least to the insured survivors, and that that's where the ambiguity exists, and that for that reason, among others, we do need to look to some legislative history. Now, the legislative history that we can look to in this case isn't just something that we can dig out of the Legislative Reference Bureau, but it's also already been cited to in a Court of Appeals case, that's the Van Erden case, where they point to, excuse me, I had these pages memorized, and on page 10 of my brief, Legislative Memorandum 96-25 to 1995 Act 21, this language would permit motor vehicle insurance policies to reduce the limit that is payable for uninsured motorist coverage for bodily injury or death payments received from other sources. Now, that is, in my view, strong legislative history evidence that what the legislature was thinking about and addressing when they passed this statute was the situation that I think common sense tells us we're normally dealing with in these situations. You've got an injured claimant or a decedent in a case such as this who's otherwise entitled to recover from a tortfeasor. The tortfeasor doesn't have insurance. They're entitled to therefore recover from their own uninsured motorist carrier to the extent possible, to the same extent that they would be entitled to recover from the tortfeasor's liability insurer. The exception to that is when they have otherwise received money from other sources as a result of the same accident or incident that gives rise to the claim in the first place, then and only then is the UM insurer entitled to reduce their policy limit by an amount equal to those payments. If you look at this legislative history, you realize that that is indeed the situation that the legislature had in mind when they authorized these reducing clauses. I believe that there is more than adequate ambiguity in the statute to clearly support the argument that no matter how your policy is written, you are not statutorily authorized to subtract from your own insured's policy limit amounts that equate to payments that were made by some entity not a party to the litigation to some other entity not a party to the litigation.
Counsel, if I can, I'm looking at 632.32, and I know you've argued the ambiguity, and maybe I'm just a bit dense on this topic. But when I look at the language under sub I-2, amounts paid or payable, not to anyone, but under the workman's comp law. And it would seem here that we have amounts payable under the workman's comp law. And I guess my question goes, and you've argued the history and you've argued the intent and what the legislature meant to do, is it not our function to interpret what the legislature in fact did?
It is exactly your function. My only disagreement with the outlook inferred in that question is that that is in fact what the legislature has done here. You are correct. The language says amounts paid under workers' compensation law. Not only does it not say to whom, it doesn't even say amounts paid under workers' compensation law because of this injury.
Well, clearly, counsel, I just want to, clearly we know, and you're talking about common sense, we know that it was paid, $159,000 was paid because of the injury received to to Scott. I mean,
Absolutely. Yeah. The sort of ridiculous example that I made in my brief to try to make what I think is a material point is that it could be argued, I would say nonsensically, but it could be argued that any payment made to anyone under any workers' compensation law for any injury would fit within this statutory definition, because after all it says is amounts paid under any workers' compensation law. It doesn't limit it to amounts paid for this injury. Similarly, it doesn't, by its words, limit it to amounts paid to or on behalf of this insured, nor, in my defense, does it expand it to amounts paid to anyone. And again, I believe there is an ambiguity there, and to simply say that it has to mean only one thing because I can come up with an explanation for why it might have meant that does not, in my opinion, answer the converse question, which is, couldn't it mean something else? And as Justice Rogensack pointed out earlier, this is a two-level analysis. Even if we want to entertain the notion that the statute authorizes an uninsured motorist carrier to reduce otherwise mandatory coverage, and we have to keep in mind that uninsured motorist coverage is mandatory, even if the statute does somehow authorize an uninsured motorist carrier to reduce otherwise mandatory coverage down to zero, your effective limits under this policy, under this fact scenario, is zero. Even if the statute authorizes that, the policy still has to use clear, specific, and unambiguous language to effect that end. And the policy is subject to the same discussion, quite frankly, that the statute is. The policy says the limits of liability of this coverage will be reduced by a payment made because of bodily injury. And to raise a point that came up earlier, bodily injury under the policy does include death. So we can read this to say a payment made because of the death under any workers' compensation law. Now, clearly, American Family makes the same argument they did before. Well, that's what this is. But again, we have to overlay this reasonable expectation of the insured issue. What is an insured looking at when they see this language? And it doesn't matter whether the particular insureds in question or the particular person entitled to recover under the policy in question in this case is the named insured himself or his parents, because we know from the case law that what we're looking at is what any reasonable insured would assume when they read this language.
Counselor, you know, this language is included in the section that I talked to opposing counsel about, the uninsured motorist section.
Right.
The identical language is also in the rider for underinsured motorist coverage. And it's the last on limits of liability, number 3. But number 1, 2, and 3 of that section all talk about payments, and they all have to be payments to the insured, because what they're doing is they're reducing the amount payment by someone that is underinsured.
Correct.
Okay. And, you know, what bothers me most, frankly, is the policy. And I'm wondering, do you know of any case from any other jurisdiction where either an uninsured motorist provision or an underinsured motorist provision dealt with payments to a third party, which is what we have here, creating circumstances that reduce the amount of the insurer's obligation to the insured?
Well, let me first acknowledge that I have not done a multi-state survey of the law on this point.
Okay, so
I am not aware of any case in which, either in the UM or the UIM context, a reducing clause was used to reduce for payments made to a third party.
Okay.
I think American Family, in some of its briefing, has pointed out a case or two where perhaps a widow or a survivor or somebody somehow connected to the family of the decedent received the payments and tried to argue that we had a certain amount of remoteness there. But there's obviously a connection there that has no application to this fact when it goes to the state of Wisconsin. So I know of no case where that happened.
Thank you.
Under the policy in question, and this is something that was, I think, better pointed out in the amicus brief, quite frankly, than in mine. They do point out that you have to view this policy language as a whole, not to mention the statute as a whole. And when we're pondering the question of what do we mean when we say payment made because of workers' compensation or under a workers' compensation law? Do we mean payment made to anyone, anywhere, whether connected to the claimant here, or do we mean payment to or on behalf of the insured claimant? The point they make is that it is tied to the enabling part of the policy. The limits of liability of this coverage will be reduced by. In other words, the amount that this policy will otherwise pay to the insured will be reduced by amounts paid under a workers' compensation law. And the point that's being made is that necessarily must also mean to the insured. That's the common sense interpretation. That is, quite frankly, the equitable interpretation. When you look at the overall effect of what American Family's argument is, and the overall effect of American Family's argument is that regardless of the fact that it did not cost the insurer anything, and regardless of the fact that it has not benefited the claimant or in this case his survivors in any way, shape, or form, these payments must still be used to reduce our obligation under the policy. And it's interesting to think, if Mr. Shearer had happened to carry $1 million worth of uninsured motorist coverage, we wouldn't even be here today, because this is a clause that reduces the policy limit. If he'd had $1 million worth of uninsured motorist coverage, even if we conceded for the sake of discussion that American Family would be entitled to a $160,000 reduction, that would still reduce the policy down to $840,000. There would still be plenty of coverage there. So to try to say, well, the legislature in its wisdom must have envisioned that it would be okay for uninsured motorist carriers to do this because they've also decided in the workers' compensation context that that's where they would draw the line is, in my opinion, to mix apples and oranges. It doesn't matter when the workers' compensation law decides to pay death benefits to the survivors versus when the workers' compensation law chooses to pay those death benefits into the state fund. What matters is what these claimants would be entitled to under the underlying tort law. And there's no argument being lodged in this case that under the underlying tort law, they are not entitled to the damages that they can prove in this case. And I cite in my brief the Ace and Robles case, not because it's factually similar, but because it does stand for the proposition that we shouldn't use workers' compensation law to analogize to tort law and vice versa. The Hansen case, American Family would argue it's in a different context, but the Hansen case holds that it is the public policy of this state to allow insurers to reduce their liability, quote, only by amounts paid to the insured, end quote, under a workers' compensation or disability benefits law. Now, American Family would argue, well, that's dicta. The issue wasn't before them. They didn't really mean to say that. But if nothing else, that phraseology in the Hansen case tells us that it is a common sense view of this area of the law that that's what reducing clauses are all about. If it's absolutely obvious that the legislature clearly intended to allow uninsured motorist insurers to deprive the insureds of money they've never seen from other sources, and if the parties to this insurance contract absolutely and clearly intended that happened in this case, then it's hard to understand how we can even have this debate. Then American Family wins hands down. But I think the fact that there is so much to talk about in a case such as this underscores the amount of question that one can ask about what's really meant by this policy language and what's really meant by the statute that authorizes this policy language. And I think the undeniable conclusion in this case is that both the legislature and the parties to this insurance contract intended for reductions to occur only when the payments in question have financially benefited the claimants. If there are no other questions, that's all I have this afternoon.
Could I ask, where did you look for legislative history?
Well, I, in this particular case, I found the legislative history that I cite to in the Van Erden case, so they found it for me, and that case is a court of appeals case.
Okay, but I mean, have you gone through the files yourself, the drafting file?
I'm trying to remember if it was this case or another. I won't swear that I've gone through all of the drafting files. I will tell you that I know of no legislative history that sheds any better light on the issue that you're asking about than the excerpt that I cited to in the Van Erden case. That's at 2004 Wisconsin Appeals 40, cited to on page 10 of my brief. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Mr. Booth.
To pick up where counsel left off, saying that there's been a lot of discussion here, I think it's important to recognize what the discussion was about. The discussion did not identify words or structure or context of the words of the statute, itself that we're dealing with, that show an ambiguity. We've been dealing with hypotheticals. We've been dealing with policy considerations. Those are the things that have been discussed. That's not the starting point. The starting point when you're dealing with ambiguity and whether you get to extrinsic factors is there something about the words or the structure or the background being the history of the statute as enacted that creates an ambiguity? And there hasn't been anything identified here. There has not been anything of that type that has been identified. It's always been some policy consideration, something extrinsic, some hypothetical. I cited the Smith versus Atlantic case. That's one statement of this court from an earlier case that indicated that hypotheticals are not the bases that this court makes its decisions.
Also, when you were sitting there and I was asking opposing counsel about the underinsured provisions and the limits of liability there are reduced by three different types of payments, the third statement being exactly the same as is contained in the uninsured provision. Can you tell me any circumstances in which the other two payments in that section would be made to anyone other than the insured or his estate? Let me read them to you. I'm sorry, it's kind of an unfair question. You have to eat your glasses like I do mine here. The first one is a payment made or an amount payable by or on behalf of any person or organization which may be legally liable or under any collectible automobile liability insurance for loss caused by an accident with an underinsured motor vehicle. The next one is a payment under the liability coverage of this policy. And the last one is the same as we talked about before, a payment made or an amount payable because of bodily injury under any workers' compensation or disability benefits law or any similar law. And it's the first two types of payment that to me seem clearly something that has to be paid to the insured or to his estate. And I'm wondering if I'm wrong in that regard and there's something, I mean, those payments could somehow be made to a third party.
Are you referring to the
I'm looking at the
uninsured or underinsured?
Underinsured has the three provisions right in a row. It's the very last part of it where it says limits of liability, and then it tells how they're reduced by three different scenarios, one of which has the same language that's used in the uninsured provision, which we talked about before. I'm still looking at it from the reasonable insured. You know, how's he going to know that if these other two reductions were because of a payment he got, that the third reduction can be for a payment he didn't get? That's the crux of what bugs me, frankly, about this case. How does he know that?
Well, first of all, to respond,
sure.
The insured, if we're talking about the insured,
sure.
Scott Shearer, and he's going to get the workers' compensation payment. So just as the earlier payments, if he's the one that's getting the payments, if he didn't die, he's the one that's going to be getting the payments under all three of those provisions.
I agree with that, but how does he know that it's also a reduction if he doesn't get it? Which is what we have here. He didn't get it. Didn't get paid to his estate, didn't get paid to him, but it's a reduction. And I don't have a problem, really, with your interpretation of the statute, but I have a problem with the policy being clear to a layperson who picks it up and buys it and says, well, under one, I get the payment. Under two, I get the payment. Why doesn't under three I get the payment?
And under three he gets the payment, too. If it is Mr. Shira, if it is instead his parents, some people who are somewhat removed from the policy, then I think that under the there are going to be the same reductions there.
No, but you see, they have a right to collect this under the policy. They're an insured person. They may not be the insured, but they are an insured person under American Family's definition.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yes.
So they have a right to collect something under the policy here, if there's anything that's not reduced out by this payment. Okay? So when I'm looking at it, I'm trying to figure out how will they know, not they being the parents, they being Scott, really the reasonable insured, how will that person know when they read this policy that under two of the scenarios, the payment reduces what they get because they receive money. But on the third scenario, the payment reduces what their estate gets and they received no money. How will they know that? What in the policy tells them that?
I think it's just the plain language. It says that whatever is received by anyone, that is going to be a reduction of the uninsured motorist coverage under the policy. And as a practical matter, when they get insurance, read these kind of terms and think about all of the various possibilities that may occur. But what they know is that if there is a payment that is made under some workers' compensation law, then there's going to be a reduction. They may not know all the details of that. They may not know that in one instance there could be a partial payment received by one person and a partial payment received by another person and a partial payment received by the state. They may not know those details about where that money goes, but they do know, based on the unambiguous language of the policy, that if there are any of those payments made, there's going to be a reduction of the limit of that coverage.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Here, of the 150 of the full payment, the first 150 went to the benefit division. Then the balance, there were two balances. Some went to the parents, and the balance went, I think there were for medical, around $1,040. So there was some, so that's a direction. There was some payment made.
Yeah,
over and above the 150.
I believe it was about 170 some paid, and 159 to the
answer
state.
Answer somewhat Justice mm-hmm. Rogancic's
and actually there was funeral expenses went to the parents, and also there is a statutory $6,500 payment made to partial dependents, and the parents qualified as a partial dependent.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Booth, and thank you, Mr. Darling, for your argument on yet another uninsured motorist case that has come to this court. That concludes our hearings on 2003 AP 3521, Teschendorf v. State Farm Insurance Companies, and it concludes our hearings for today. The court will meet in conference at 3:10.